Welcome to today's podcast, the sixth in the series titled, Is Worth Considering. Does it seem to you that life is a bit out of control? If you think so, you're not alone. This short podcast is to help all of us consider the teachings of Christ, even in these out of control times. I'm Pastor David, the assistant pastor at Bethel Gilead Community Church, also known as the Church on Block Road. My guest for this discussion is Rick Chard. We're going to be discussing the tornado devastation in Rolling Fork, Mississippi. Rick is a Red Cross volunteer, both at home in Branch County, and when he's deployed to areas like Hazard in Jackson, Kentucky, where they had that flood, or Florida, or anywhere else they may send him. All right, here we are. Hey, welcome, Rick. I'm glad you could join me this morning. And as we're going to be talking about your experience as you went down south. And with that said, let me just allow you to explain who you volunteer for and what was your last deployment?
Basically, I volunteer for the American Red Cross, belong to this Southwest Michigan chapter, which is based in Kalamazoo and encompasses I can't remember how many counties, but the counties in the Southwest Michigan portion of Michigan. My last deployment was in Mississippi for the tornadoes, and I got back this past Friday. I was down there for just shy of 2 weeks.
2 weeks. So is that the typical length of time that you will go on a deployment?
Typical deployment is 14 days.
Okay.
Yeah, or 2 weeks. That's what they like you to commit for.
And so when you're up here in Bronson, you're also volunteering for the Red Cross as well, right?
Yeah, my wife and I are the, it's not supposed to be this way, but it is. We're the DAT team for Branch County. We respond to disasters in the county, which include house fires. We respond to all the house fires in Branch County.
Hey, with that said, how does that happen? Does the fire department call you? Do you listen to a scanner? How does that happen?
It either we get call from 911, we get calls, there's a couple of the fire departments that call us direct, or they call through Red Cross and we get a call through Red Cross. It's kind of varies on how we get notified. It's according to what fire department it is.
So usually when you show up then, right, the fire can be underway, the firefighters may still be fighting the fire, and you'll find, you know, who the homeowners are and such. Is that how it works?
Yeah. Typically, we're there while the fire department's still there. We meet with the homeowner. If it's a destroyed fire or major fire, then we actually give the residents a debit card that night. As we're there, after we get everything filed for their immediate needs, it helps give them. They get anywhere from $500, or actually it's $515 up through. It can be a little over $1,000, and it's for their immediate needs to get them in a hotel that night, get them clothes, get them fed, get whatever they need. But they can use that money for whatever they
sure. I would imagine then. I mean, everything's lost in the fire. They may not have access at that time to any cash, and so you serve a really helping hands there. Now, with that said, how often will you go on a call here in town?
Branch County is, obviously, we don't have tons of fires. We'll be, we haven't been on a fire for probably a month, and then we may go two or three in a week.
Oh, wow.
It obviously there's no control over how many fires there's going to be.
Sure. Now, so with that said, you've seen the devastation that fires bring. And now you went and you were deployed down south. Was it Mississippi, you said?
Yeah.
And so how would you describe what you witnessed down in Mississippi compared to the devastation that you see in a single family home fire?
Well, there probably is no comparison because, I mean, what we saw in Mississippi were towns you know, the size of the towns in this area, and they're gone. I mean, they're literally...
So like Bronson, the size of Bronson.
Bronson would be gone.
So I mean, all those houses and those
houses,
stores...
Houses, businesses, everything are completely gone.
So when you say gone...
I mean, like leveled. There's nothing there.
So you just see rubble.
And they just, they lost their cars. Cars were rolled down the roads. I mean, so cars are gone. Their jobs are gone. Their houses are gone. Everything they own are gone. And it was pretty amazing. I shouldn't say amazing. That's probably not the right term, but
probably awe-striking.
It just kind of looked like you took a bulldozer and just pushed everything over and piled it into piles.
Yeah. Now, from the time you had told me this, but you can repeat it for our for the purposes today, you were saying that when the tornado warning went off, there was an actual alarm.
Right.
And then what happened? How long did that...
The county turned the alarm on for a tornado warning that one was coming. And within 2 minutes, the tornado had taken the alarm out. So these people had basically a two-minute warning. And the other thing you've got to realize is, like, when you get down south, no one has basements. So even though you have a warning, there really isn't a lot to do.
And this happened at, like, 11 o'clock at night?
11 o'clock at night. So you had people sleeping. You had people, you know, watching the news. You had people, you know. And like I say, there's nowhere for them to go. So they get a warning, they just kind of know it's coming, but there's not a lot to do about
it. Sure, and if you're watching television, if you actually hear the warning,
right,
and then you're stopping to think, did I just hear a tornado warning? And then all of a sudden, and I would imagine that storm, if I remember correctly, really was moving quite quickly.
Yeah, it was 150 miles an hour.
Wow.
So you didn't have a lot. You know, the 2 minutes, that wasn't very far outside of town. And it took a swatch 100 and I think it was 100 and almost I think it's 150 miles long.
150, wow. So what we're talking about is really, if we were from here to Chicago, I mean, not quite to Chicago, but the west side of Indiana.
And it was two tornadoes going side by side. So the width of destruction was huge too, because it, you know, you had two tornadoes and then kind of everything in the middle was still affected by, because they weren't that far apart. I mean, it'd probably be like, it might be between like Coldwater and Bronson, the distance between the two little towns that got devastated the worst. And I'm talking, you know, their high school's gone, their middle school's gone, their elementary school's beyond use. Yesterday I was reading Cooper Tire, which is owned by Goodyear. It's their largest facility in the country, and it's now shut down because of damage. And it was in one of these little towns, so it was still there, but it's beyond use.
Right. I mean, if we could have just pictured this in our own mind here, if that, like, would hit in Sturgis and go right up Route 12.
Right.
It would hit Bronson, Burr Oak, it'd take out coal. I mean, the devastation would be just huge.
Yeah, everyone in Quincy, you know, everything along US 12 would just be gone. And like I say, not only they lose, I mean, their cars, what cars are left, basically you'll see them driving down the road with trash bags taped over their windows because they have no glass left in them. So it was, you know, there's no one that wasn't, you know, really majorly affected by it.
So I can imagine, so you're down there, you know, you drive into that situation, and I would say it's probably worse than a war zone, because a war zone, you see shells of buildings still left, but here, there's just nothing.
Correct.
Why? And then I hate to talk about it, but the reality is you're talking about a town of Bronson, about 2,000 people, and you're talking about two towns about the size of Bronson, and yet the number of people at the time where you left who had actually been killed through this, was it about 25 or?
Yeah, and last count was 22. They was up to 26, but then they narrowed that down to 22. But, you know, the downside of that, they haven't started removing houses yet. And being the time of night it hit and the destruction of these houses, I'd be really surprised if that number didn't, you know, increase drastically when they start moving, you know,
sure,
rubble
as they go through. And
right.
And But with that said, you probably also talked to people. You know, I think you told me about one gentleman who was in a crazy kind of way. His house was taken, but he survived.
Right.
What was that story? How'd that happen?
Yeah, Cliff, he was 80, I think he was 84, 85, I don't remember. He was one of the few that actually, the only place, he went to a shelter. He had no relatives or anything. So we got to talk to him a lot. And he had actually fallen asleep that evening watching TV and his lazy boy in his house in his living room. And he woke up and he virtually had no house. I mean, his house was gone, and he was still sitting as a lazy boy in the spot where his living room was. So
that's crazy.
I mean, he's become a real believer.
Oh, you're not kidding. When you think everything has been taken away from around you, and yet you're not injured.
Right.
And you're sitting and waking up as though God's come down here, protected you, but took everything else away. My, oh my. Were there any other instances that you would, or stories you would hear about?
Not really, other than the fact that, you know, I've been on, you know, not, you know, dozens and dozens of deployments, but quite a few deployments over the last 5 years around the country in different types of disasters. And I don't know if it's because it was in the South and or what, but these people were, you know, have lost everything they got and never really been in an area where we receive, you know, so much thanks from people that have lost everything, and they still were thankful for what little bit you was giving them. Because in essence, we weren't doing a lot for them. We was trying to provide them housing or shelters, but the shelters were very low attended because these people went to families. They went to, you know, they kind of are self-sufficient. They take care of themselves.
It's just, you know, I guess when everything has been taken away, I imagine you see that at house fires too, where the loved ones are outside the house, they're watching their home being, you know, burned to the ground, but they have their arms around one another. They're recognizing we got out safely.
Yeah. And in this case, because they're, you know, the way the destruction was, there literally could have been hundreds of people, you know, lost their lives. So, you know, not to slight 22 people, it's a lot of people, but it isn't when you compare, when you really look at it and think about how many could have lost their lives.
Sure, the thousands.
Very easily lost their lives.
Right, the thousands of people who could have easily been taken, and, you know, reasonably so, right, when you see that type of devastation. So, now you've been on other deployments too. How would you... I hate to say rank this, but how, when it looked at devastation and experience, how would you view this compared to some of the other places that you've been? And where have you been? Where have you gone before?
We've been, I was just looking the other night, we've been to Florida a couple of times. We've been as far out as California. We've been in, actually, we had it over by Detroit. We had set up a shelter there for 2 weeks or 3 weeks. I was over there running that shelter, and I never can pronounce this day. I've been in Iowa.
Did you go down to Kentucky as well?
Yeah, that's right. We just got back from Kentucky about 3 months ago, 2 months ago.
So that was a very impoverished area too.
Yeah, that was flooding.
But
nothing, I mean, the destruction just wasn't, you know, even in a tornado, you'll see, you know, a few spotty houses gone and damaged, but you don't see everything gone. I mean, there isn't even a tree left in these towns. I mean, they're just kind of like stumps. So, I mean, you know, it's a whole different concept of destruction.
So when you first came down and you saw this, you know, this devastation, I'm sure that it had to have an impact. And by the time you left, you know, 2 weeks later, having time to absorb some of it, but, you know, what was your first assessment? And then how did you, when you came back, how has that changed your view of things?
Well, it's like where we went. I was assigned to be a shelter supervisor at the armory in the first town we went to. Well, by the time we got there, the hospital had been destroyed, so they turned the armory into a hospital. So, you know, it wasn't available for Red Cross to put a shelter in. And as it turned out, that town never, the shelter never got above three people. And that was a mother and her 16-year-old son and Cliff, the guy that was in the, you know, lost his house. And
let me stop you just for a second. So you were saying that there was a hospital that was destroyed?
Yes.
So that kind of gives us an idea. I mean, there's no hospital in Bronson. There's barely one right. in Sturgis. Coldwater has a hospital. That kind of gives us a picture. If the town is big enough to have a hospital, it's reasonably good size. Not medium size, but...
Yeah, well, like this tire company, they employ 1,200 people. So, I mean, it's a pretty good size facility. And so one of their larger tire, I think, is the third in the country as far as tire facility. But it is a little different down there. I think because they're so remote, I think you find, you know, the small towns have their own hospitals because there really isn't.
Okay.
But they aren't, you know, it's not like going to Parkview, you know, type thing. You know, they're small.
So when you went down there, you saw this devastation, you know, what was your first impression?
I guess the first impression was, you know, like I say, it's never seen anything like it. I mean, you know, you're used to seeing, I mean, even if you see like, you know, even war, you know, there's buildings, they may be damaged, but you don't lose the whole city. I mean, you know, it's spotty in here. It was pretty awesome. I said awesome, or that's probably not the proper word.
But, sure, but how else can you describe
yeah,
it, right?
I mean, it makes you really realize how fast things can, how you can lose everything.
Now, when you went down there, did you see a lot of people, you know, kind of wandering around or looking for their homes, or was it pretty vacant?
It was pretty vacant. By time, you know, because we got there, it was 3 days after the tornado. So by then, people had, you know, found somewhere to go. Plus the fact they pretty much had all these little towns quartered off. You know, law enforcement was huge. I mean, you either, you know, we got in with our Red Cross IDs, but you just didn't drive into these town areas. I mean, they were pretty well blocked off, and there's two or three police cars at every entrance into every town. And
so you were saying police officers, you had...
There was prison guards, there was DNR, there was, you know, county police, state police, local police, everything you could, you know, every type of police officer or law enforcement. If you had a badge and a uniform, you were there.
Yeah. It just seems as though, you know, when you watch the news, there just seems to be more and more natural disasters that are going. And it seems as though, I hate to say it, but first responders have really learned from previous, you know, times of how they're responding. You said there were trucks that were lined up to come in and to help, utilities?
Your utility companies, power companies were there, I mean, with trailer loads of power poles, because you'd drive down a road and every power pole would be snapped off. I mean, they had, you know, I would say, or probably in that area, there was at least 100 power company trucks. And they were there, you know, loaded down with supplies, you know, because they bring everything with them and come in from all over. I know when we, coming back from Kentucky, we was actually following trucks still coming into Kentucky. The response, how fast they respond and get to these areas. Because like this place, when you get into these towns, because there's so many trees and rubble and you couldn't get down the streets, and they had trucks, basically double semis with claw cranes attached to them. They were designed to do what they were doing, and there was multiples of them there. And where they come from, I have no idea. But yeah. You know, like,
so the logistics have really improved. Yeah. But you also were saying also there are other organizations outside the Red Cross that you see show up at these.
Yeah, there was multiple churches feeding people, you know, giving out water. I've never seen so many cases of water piled up. Salvation Army was there. All your insurance companies are there with not just helping people fill out forms and stuff, but they were there with stuff. You know, they were with water and food. And the humorous end of it is you drive through these neighborhoods and everybody's still out in their front yards barbecuing. And it's like, how did they not lose, they lose their house, but they didn't lose their barbecue. And
they didn't lose their sense of humor either.
I mean, you just drive along, here's all these people out in their front yards with their grills going. And that was kind of the humorous part of the whole thing.
You know, so it's a very impoverished area. And there'd be one part you would say, well, they didn't lose much, but they lost everything.
Yes.
Everything they could possibly have had, they lost.
And this is an area where if you read the information given out, you know, the average household income was $18,000. And the one little town that got completely destroyed, that town is the lowest family income or household income in the United States. So it was obviously less than $18,000.
I mean, so that's $9 an hour is really what it comes down to.
If you got a family of two or three or four, that's what you're supporting your whole family on. And the other amazing thing is that I was really surprised at is you just kind of expected to see like trailers and trailers and trailers. Most of these are houses, you know, stick-built houses.
When you told me that was rather surprising. Mm-hmm. I would have expected them to be double wides or trailers, but...
No. You saw very, actually, surprisingly, there were some trailer parks and out there, but you saw very few actual trailers. And that's what I thought. And to give you how this storm did, like there was one truck terminal, probably had 200 semi-trailers in the parking lot. And they were all laying on their sides. Didn't blow them away, but they tipped them over like dominoes. I mean, some of the damage or types of damage was, it really made you look and think about, I guess, and at the end of 2 weeks, and we actually left a day early, because they give you a day off, so we took our day off and flew home. He was ready to go. This is probably the first deployment I've ever been on where I really was ready to go home. And, you know, the sad thing is I could go home and...
Sure.
Those people didn't have a choice. They had to try and figure out. And it's going to take... I mean, I'd hate to think how long it's going to take just to get those areas cleaned up. Because, like, we were there for 2 weeks and they were still cleaning up, just trying to get the streets open so you could drive down them.
So you're in the...
I only went through one tire.
So you were in the first deployment, and usually there's a follow-up. How many deployments are there that follow up?
I'm guessing they'll probably be there, Red Cross. That's kind of the sad thing is because it's kind of like the first couple of weeks, organizations flood these areas with help. And then towards the end of the first couple of weeks, you start seeing the tents come down, and even though the need's still there, you start seeing people pulling out. Red Cross stays until like the bitter end. I'm guessing they'll be down there. They're still in Kentucky, and that was a couple months ago. And there's still deployment in Kentucky. There's still deployment in California, and that's been, you know, a couple months ago. They'll probably be here. I would say they'll be there for 4 or 5 months at least.
It is. I can imagine that 2 weeks and you're down there and you're ready to come back. You can only give so much of yourself emotionally and everything else without it wearing you away. And so it's good to have organizations like the Red Cross or Salvation Army or is it the Baptists who a lot of times?
Baptist was there. Billy Graham was there. And then and this is the other amazing thing. You got all the local churches there with tents up and giving away water and all that. And these people don't have houses either. You know, they're there giving and their house is probably gone too. But probably their church is gone. I mean,
sure.
There.
You hear about it, right? You see the worst of, you hear so oftentimes the worst of humanity. I mean, we've had mass shootings that have just gone uncontrolled, and then you see the best of humanity, you know, and it seems like we have such a wide swing of experiences so closely piled up one after the other in this time in which we are living. With that said, would you encourage people to get involved with the Red Cross or any of these organizations?
Yeah, I mean, I've always, since my younger days when I was in the JCs, I mean, I've always been involved in some kind of volunteer thing. We still, like tomorrow, we'll be up to the Air National Guard base up in Battle Creek. We work, my wife and I do a welcome center there one Saturday every month when they come in and do IDs and stuff like that. I just have always done some kind of volunteering, worked on a volunteer ambulance service for 7 years.
So you're kind of a veteran when it comes to volunteering.
You know, and so it's just kind of like my dad volunteered. He was on the local rescue squad. I mean, it's just something I grew up with. And this past deployment was probably, like I say, had the most impact of any deployment I've been on, probably anything I volunteered towards. But and you don't really do it for satisfaction. You do it because people, you know, it's tough when you see people like that that are in such need. And if someone's not doing it, I mean, I don't know what these people would do. It's 90 degrees out and they don't have anywhere to go. It's not like, you know, even, at least at night, I could still go back to a hotel even though it's 2.5 hours away. And lay in a bed in an air-conditioned room. These people, I'm not sure where. We went to a little diner one day, and we was talking to the people in there, and virtually everybody in that diner had their houses destroyed, and they were in there getting a meal. And when we got up to pay, someone had bought our meal.
They who lost everything.
I mean, you know,
paid for your meal.
And it's like, you know, it's pretty humbling when you...
Isn't that crazy? The more you're help going to help and to give, and you're just seeing in return,
right,
you know, thank you, mm-hmm, and just their appreciation. And I think that's the biggest thing is, you know, as an assistant pastor of a church, I realize that we need volunteers just in the simple way of conducting, you know, God's work in the church. And it's rewarding. It's rewarding for those who give up their time and their efforts. And I guess so I listen to you and you've gone out and volunteered so often, it might be intimidating for somebody who really, I would like to, they might think, but they've never done it. Would you encourage it? Is it difficult to get started?
The first time Terry and I got deployed, we went to Florida. And it was, I guess you could use it, you're scary and going because you don't have any idea what you're getting into. We just really lucked out and had a supervisor that was very, very good. She was retired military, and she spent a lot of time with Terry and I and gave us different tasks to do and assignments to do and got our fingers into a lot of different things. So we got to see a lot of opportunity there that, you know, sometimes you have a supervisor and you'll be, you know, this is your job, you're going to do that for 2 weeks and you don't do anything else. So we just really lucked out on our first deployment.
You know, so I listened to you and it just reminds me that the greatest among us is the one who is willing to serve. As Christ says, you want to be great in the kingdom? Go out and serve. And the beautiful thing is about being a servant, you go and you do simply as you're asked to do. And so you can come with skill base, but a lot of times you're never using that. You're going to be doing something like passing out water or, you know, it could be anything. So, all right. Well, hey, Rick, I want to thank you. Thank you for your opportunity to come and share with us about your experience in the Red Cross, as well as thank you for serving. It's good to know what's out there before you ever need it. Well, God bless you, my friend. Okay. Thank you much.
Thank you.
Thank you for spending time to listen to today's podcast, the sixth in the series, It's Worth Considering. We hope you continue to tune in and don't drop out as we end our discussion with Rick Chard, We have more to discuss, but it will have to wait for a later time. Until then, go out as God's ambassadors, commissioned to a world, well, in desperate need of the gospel. God bless.